Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Today, we are discussing media coverage of the elections in Myanmar. Aung San Suu Kyi's opposition National League for Democracy Party won a historic victory today. It was a major victory for Suu Kyi especially, who has spent 15 years under house arrest. But the military has 25% of the seats in the parliament. The military revised the constitution in 2008 to secure those 25% of seats. Joining us to talk about coverage of these elections and how the outcome will change Myanmar is Paul Mooney. He's a veteran freelance journalist who has reported on Burma, China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong since 1985. He's worked for Reuters, Newsweek, the South China Morning Post, and Knight Ritter Financial News. And Paul joins me in studio. Hi, Paul. Nice to see you.
How are you?
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And The Nation magazine is celebrating its 150th anniversary. In the anniversary issue, editor and publisher Katrina Vandenhoevel writes, quote, "Change is inevitable, but the one constant in the nation's history has been faith, not in political parties or policies, but in what can happen when you tell people the truth. It is this notion that has sustained the nation since its founding. That and the idea that there are always alternatives in history, in politics, in life that would make our country and the world a more humane, just, and secure place," end quote. Katrina Vandenhoevel will be on a panel about inequality on Tuesday at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. She'll be on with yesterday's guest, Robert Reich, and Van Jones and Ai-Jen Poo. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. And Katrina Vandenhoevel joins us from New York. Hi, Katrina. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Katrina, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Thank you for beginning with me. I go back to, it's a blockbuster series that it's three parts, New York Times. It launched October 31st. It's not the sexiest series, but it's about arbitration. What it's really about is rigging the system. There's been a coup against ordinary people in the last decade, a move to block class action suits engineered by Wall Street-led coalition of credit card companies and retailers. Maybe one of the most profound shifts in our legal history, which is closing off civil justice to millions of people, because by banning these class actions, companies have essentially disabled consumer challenges to practices like predatory lending, wage theft, discrimination. So I'd recommend your listeners go to the New York Times series launched October 31. It's called Arbitration Everywhere, Stacking the Deck of Justice.
Fresh Air's Terry Gross talked about that issue, that series, yesterday, and I read one of the pieces. They're really long, and they're on my list. Katrina, how are citizens going to fight against this? Is there anything people can do based on what you read?
You know, I am not a lawyer, but we do now have, it seems to me, a political discussion in this country in the last 2 years, a better understanding of the rigged economic system, rigged against ordinary working people. So that there are now groups, as you know, change begins with exposing the abuses, the injustice. So there is some legislation, both at the state and at the federal level, that is in play. There are various lawsuits. And there are political figures like Elizabeth Warren, who was the founder of the Consumer Financial Protection Board. Very rarely do working families, working people, have a voice inside Washington. Elizabeth Warren and others have given those people a voice, and that Consumer Financial Protection Board is part of a fight back against these small details, these arbitration clauses that have been inserted into a soaring number of consumer and employment contracts. So I think there's the beginning of people joining together to fight back. It will be a long haul because this has been more than a decade in the making, as I said. Mm. And the Supreme Court Justice John Roberts, as a private lawyer, had his paws all over this in working to limit civil justice and access to civil justice. So it's both a legal case strategy that needs to happen, political and organizing, to take on this arbitration lockdown.
Right, and the Supreme Court just this week heard a case for workers at a Tyson pork processing plant in Iowa. They say that they have not been paid overtime and they want to join a class action. So this is going to be a really important decision.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, corporations are allowed to strip people of their constitutional right to go to court. That's what this series exposes, what we've seen. You know, imagine the reaction if you took away people's Second Amendment right to own a gun. I mean, there needs to be an understanding. It is complex, but at its bottom line, it is very simple that this is really shafting working people, ordinary people who don't have access to these high-priced corporate lawyers or to the courts increasingly.
Right. Yeah, and some of the stories in that piece were heartbreaking. So kudos to the New York Times for this investigation and series on these class actions. And we should do a show about this. Thank you for that. That's Katrina Vandenhoevel. She is editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. They're celebrating their 150th anniversary this year. And what about you, Paul? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I saw an interesting article by Reuters, an investigative piece that uncovered Chinese ownership or control of radio stations around the world, including in the U.S., obscured. This was a huge effort. Some 39 reporters, four continents, they uncovered, you know, financial records on ownership. You know, they monitored radio broadcast, and they basically found out that China's broadcasting, you know, state propaganda on these stations. And the U.S. government wasn't even aware of the stations in the U.S. that were controlled by China Radio International.
What kind of radio stations?
Pretty much mainstream. There's one in Washington. I think it's called WCRW. That broadcasts right in Washington, D.C. And they gave several examples of stories that they'd run where they kind of left out certain details or glossed over certain facts or distorted things. So, and this is right in our own capital.
And so this is new. This new money is flowing into these stations.
Yeah, China's, for the last 5 or 6 years, China's been making an effort to put a spin on the news. They feel that the international media has been kind of reporting negatively on China. So they're actually investing in a lot of things like this and, you know, trying to kind of take back control of the China story.
And what's the reaction been?
I don't know. You know, it's my feeling is that a lot of people just discount things that come from the state media. But with these radio stations, we don't know. People don't know who owns it. They don't know who's behind it. So, you know, but it's hard just to know what kind of impact it's having. If it's China Daily has supplements in the New York Times, Washington Post, but they're described as being China Daily supplements, and people know that the government, state media is biased. But with the radio stations, it's hidden. No one knows who the owners are.
It'll be interesting to see if Reuters follows this to find out if the content changes
that
in
would
the
be
coming
interesting.
Months.
Yes, yeah, that would be interesting.
All right, so kudos to Reuters for this piece about Chinese-owned radio stations,
right.
Not just financed, but they're owning the stations.
There's a variety of ways, but they're controlled. You know, so it's a. Yeah.
All right. And that is Paul Mooney. He is a veteran freelance journalist who has reported from China since 1985 and other countries. And you can find links to these stories at yourcallradio.org. So let's dive in and talk about media coverage of the historic elections in Burma. Aung San Suu Kyi's Opposition League for Democracy Party won a historic victory today. How big of a deal is this, Paul? I mean, it's huge for Aung San Suu Kyi because she spent 15 years under house arrest.
Yeah, it's huge. You know, the National League for Democracy, Aung San Suu Kyi, they've been you know, fighting for democracy for decades now. And, you know, everyone expected that they would do well in the election, but I think they've done far better than even the National League for Democracy expected. And so it shows a real strong public, you know, distaste for the military kind of backed ruling party.
And it's the first time that voters have been able to take part in a competitive election.
In decades, yes.
And so what was the mood like? What was voter turnout like?
It was quite large, there was a, you know, real feeling of excitement. I'd left Myanmar before the election, but from monitoring on the news and TV, people were quite excited. There were there was just a lot of excitement and happiness that the NLD had done so well. And apparently the support came from everyone from the ethnic areas, even some of the cronies that are very kind of close to the military went on record as saying they voted for the NLD. So there's a widespread support for Aung San Suu Kyi. And she's the daughter of Aung San, who's kind of like the George Washington of Burma, who fought against the British, and he was assassinated in a coup in 62. So he's very popular, and she kind of, you know, enjoys the popularity by being his daughter.
We were talking before the show about foreign bureaus and just the state of international coverage, and it's so sad that we got news from McClatchy recently that they're going to shut down their foreign bureaus. Talk a little bit about international outlets in Myanmar. What kind of news is this getting in the United States?
In Myanmar, the presence in the international media is quite small. Burma only opened up in 2012. Before that, it was quite difficult for journalists to even get into Myanmar. It's improved dramatically, but maybe there's not interest around the world. I don't know. But in Myanmar, I think there's less than a half dozen actual foreign bureaus in the country that have, you know, kind of staff reporters reporting on what's happening there. So,
and Katrina, how does The Nation cover something like this? We found a piece by John Pfeffer. He wrote a piece in joint publication with The Nation and Foreign Policy in Focus.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's we have freelance writers, reporters, often based in the country, but often more analytical interpreters, people who've had experience studying the history and the country, but are not based there now. But I think the point about the point Paul raised and you raised about international coverage in these times is a vitally important one. It seemed to me that in the aftermath of 9/11, that the country, there was an opportunity to turn to, the country was more interested in the world. The sadness is, like so much of our politics, it became a politics of fear, so that you didn't have a sense of a media landscape opening up, opening new bureaus, expanding, investing. There are new forms of international journalism. I think of Vice. But the ability to understand what is going on in the world outside of the prism of fear still seems to me a very difficult one, and leads us, I fear, too often in this country to adopt a kind of, media narrative, media coverage has consequences, and too often it leads to kind of bellicose posturing on the part of our political figures, which ends up isolating the United States and undermining our security, instead of a more varied, nuanced, especially historical kind of coverage that would allow people to understand the various forces at work in different countries. But the one-sided media narrative, especially, I follow Russia, and the one-sided media narrative that we have seen emerge around U.S.-Russian relations, Russia-Ukrainian conflict, now Russian-Syrian-U.S. conflict, I think is very dangerous. And not saying, there's a right or a wrong, but just to have really relentlessly one-sided coverage that Russia can only do wrong, not understanding that, there are areas we need to partner in, whether it was the Iran deal or nuclear proliferation or climate. I think that kind of media coverage often overdetermines the engagement of America in the world.
What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, when I first got to China in 1994, there was a rather large international media presence there. And over the last, 4 or 5 years, I've seen colleague after colleague leave as bureaus shut down. The Baltimore Sun, Newsday, Newsweek, just publication after publication, even McClatchy News, they've closed down. And so we're down now to really kind of for Americans, the New York Times, Washington Post, L.A. Times, Christian Science Monitor. There's not much of an American media presence there anymore. And people are doing less longer pieces, less investigative pieces.
Right. And then outlets also have to rely on freelancers in most cases.
That's right. Yeah.
That is Paul Mooney. He's a veteran freelance journalist. He's worked for Reuters, Newsweek, the South China Morning Post. He's been reporting from Burma, China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong since 1985. Katrina Vandenhoevel is publisher and editor of The Nation magazine. They're celebrating their 150th anniversary this year. Katrina will be on a panel about inequality on Tuesday in San Francisco at the Herbst Theater, and that is at, I believe it's, 7 o'clock. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. She'll be on with yesterday's guest, Robert Reich. And what are your thoughts on the state of investigative journalism? Where do you go for your international news? And if you've been following the elections in Myanmar, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Now, Paul, You say that it's very important to point out that the military in Myanmar revised the constitution in 2008, which gave them 25% of the seats in the parliament.
Right.
And so what does that mean exactly, and also just for these elections?
Well, in terms, you know, the constitution was revised in 2008. One of the revisions was prohibiting anyone with a relative that had a foreign passport running for president. Aung San Suu Kyi's late husband was British. Her two sons have foreign passports. So although she would be the popular choice to be president, overwhelmingly, she can't run for president. So the NLD will nominate someone else. They definitely will be able to kind of name the next president. And she caused a bit of a stir last week because she said she'll be above the president. Her way of saying, even though I can't run, I'm going to. But it, in a way, it doesn't matter. You can't bring about any constitutional change in the parliament unless you get more than 75% of the vote, but the military has an automatic 25% that they nominate themselves. The military also controls three important ministries: defense, interior, and border security. And in a lot of ways, they supersede the government, the president, and the parliament. So, it's a step forward. It's very positive, and people are excited about it. We won't expect to see a lot of real changes on the ground.
Right. I was going to ask you, because there's so much attention on the military and Aung San Suu Kyi, as there should be, but what about the people? Because we were talking about just the uprisings that have happened in Myanmar over the last decade.
Yeah. I think one of the problems will be that people have very high expectations. And the NLD is going to have difficulty meeting those expectations, and we can expect the military and the current ruling party to do everything it can to upset or prevent the NLD from bringing about much change, and this could cause a lot of kind of disappointment among the people in Myanmar.
And Katrina, what are your thoughts about how the democracy is being reported in the news? Because John Pfeffer's piece is called Burma, Democracy with an Asterisk. And just a quick news search, democracy is in almost every headline. International New York Times, a milestone for Myanmar's democracy. UPI, Myanmar chooses Suu Kyi to usher in democracy. How do you think the media, and how should they report on that word democracy in this context?
Let me just, if I could, flip that a little, because in our 150th special issue, our editorial board member, terrific historian Eric Foner, he's a historian of the Civil War, of Reconstruction, has an essay about freedom. If there are contested terms in our life, landscape, media, democracy is one, freedom is one. How do we define democracy? Do we define it within a country's culture and history? There is also the term illiberal democracy. So you have the veneer of democracy, yet a military may control that country. I think that for the most part, democracy has been bandied about too easily in the media, and often in the context, at least in U.S. coverage, of democracy is what we have. Well, let me, share the news. I don't think you or Paul will be shocked that democracy in this country right now is quite fragile. And I think it's been an interesting media moment in these last years to see movements arise questioning how strong our democracy is. We have a presidential debate underway in which at least one candidate is raising questions about whether we're an oligarchy, a plutocracy, or a democracy. And then, sadly, too often the United States, and the nation has covered this in different ways, has roamed the world in the name of democracy, but often what we have done more of is regime change in the name of democracy. And that, I think, is a very dangerous conceit. And I do think our media, Rose, is still defined too much by, if I might, what I'd call sort of armchair warriors, the warrior intellectuals who were responsible for Iraq, for example, and who continue to dominate too much of the mainstream coverage, media coverage, in defining what America's role in the world should be. I think we need a really different conception of that. One hopes that those ideas emerge in campaigns and elections, but often they emerge from outside. And if there's one constant throughout the nation's 150th years, it has been the idea that empire is toxic for democracy.
And Paul, John Pfeffer, in this piece, he's co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus, writes that democracies are subject to more structural problems. So he points out Citizens United in the United States, which reinforces the sad reality that only the wealthiest citizens can run for office in the U.S. Government restrictions on the media, such as the case in Russia, produces questionable election results. So how will this play out in Myanmar?
If you look at the election, this overwhelming victory for the NLD, it's because they moved in a direction toward democracy. So we have, people were able to use the internet. The newspapers are not complete freedom of the press yet, but they were quite active and they're much more open than they were 4 or 5 years ago. People were able to go to rallies. People were able to campaign. There were protests. And although it's not a perfect system, this all fed into the victory for the NLD. So it's not, again, democracy is not perfect anywhere, but we can see how this kind of limited democracy has already had a kind of a positive effect in Myanmar.
Well, were any platforms discussed? I mean, what kinds of changes might we see? Because, as you said, Aung San Suu Kyi cannot be president, but she has said, quote, "I make all the decisions because I'm the leader of the winning party, and the president will be one whom we will choose just in order to meet the requirements of the Constitution. The president will have to understand this perfectly well, that he will have no authority, that he will act in accordance with the positions of the party," end quote.
You know, it's limited by one of the flaws in the political system in Myanmar, that the military still supersedes the president and the government in a lot of aspects. And another problem with the NLD is that, and I reported on them for about a year and a half, was they had no real political platform. They had no kind of concrete economic policy. They had no shadow government. They didn't, I interviewed people from the NLD and they were totally unprepared for. So I'm a little bit, what's going to happen now that they're taking power? They don't seem to have made any preparations for it. So, what kind of democracy do we have then if they're not haven't made plans to do anything? And we don't know really what they're going to do. Aung San Suu Kyi has never really said what she plans to do.
And what about people who are persecuted? I mean, you also say that it's important to point out that Muslim candidates wanted to run, but they couldn't.
Yeah, there were several Muslim candidates who weren't allowed to run, including several from the Rohingya, a Muslim minority area in northwest Myanmar. People who were already in parliament, they were not allowed to run for re-election. And the NLD didn't nominate one Muslim candidate because in Myanmar, it's sort of political suicide. The Rohingya have been severely abused for quite a while. The NLD has never come out. Aung San Suu Kyi, who is the goddess of democracy, never came out and made a positive statement in support of the Rohingyas because, and analysts said, it would have been political suicide. There's very strong anti-Muslim feelings in Myanmar, and nobody wanted to risk the election by doing the right thing.
Did that get a lot? Oh, sure,
just,
Katrina.
Jump in. Yeah, I was the Rohingya Muslims. It's Paul knows far more about this, but one thing that strikes me is that we are, as we rightly should be, focused on the refugee crisis emerging from the Syrian conflict, from Afghanistan. I believe that we're looking possibly at 60 million people displaced in refugee status around the world today, larger number than at any time since World War II. But there are underreported crises, and what's happening to the Rohingya Muslims is certainly one of them. What's happening to the Haitians, Dominican Haitians in the Dominican Republic, is another refugee crisis. So there is a great need at this time for more reporting. I think what we're witnessing is a bit of a transition where some of these human rights groups often play the role of an early alert warning system, not necessarily journalistic, but they are bringing attention to these crises, and then journalists, the media, come to those. But it is a tumultuous time, vertiginous, and the media, the way it is organized, is, in my view, it's a the older order, the older system is disappearing. The new media system is not yet known. We're in this kind of twilight. The nation does with it what it can. I mean, I would just point out one thing, that we were played an important role at the time of the war in Iraq. I think it's often forgotten how brutally coercive the conventional wisdom was in that autumn of 2002 and winter of 2003. And it wasn't just the neocons. There were many liberal hawks pushing that war. And we said no very loudly and publicly. That is a role we play. And the other is to bring investigative journalism like Jeremy Scahill, who was with us for many years. His work on Blackwater, in my mind, redefined the way we now read about war when we pick up the mainstream news and read about special ops. You read about it in a different way, in my mind, because he changed the way we think about 21st century warfare. So there are different roles for different media, but we all need to play a role to engage the international, global landscape.
Katrina VandenHeuvel is editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, and Paul Mooney is a veteran journalist who has reported from Burma, China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong since 1985. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. If you'd like to ask an email question or comment, the address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Feedback@yourcallradio.org. 866-798-8255 is the live call-in number. That's 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Peabody Award-winning investigative journalistic program Reveal. And at noon today, it's the Tavis Smiley Show here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about the growing number of people facing astronomical rent increases and evictions in San Francisco and the Greater Bay Area. How can renters protect themselves in the most expensive market in the country, housing market? And what are cities doing to protect tenants' rights? What is the state of rent control in the Bay Area? And we're also putting shows together next week about transportation issues. With so many people moving to the Bay Area and many calls for new housing, what about transportation? If you're on the highway, I know that you probably want to hear this show because things have gotten so busy in the last year. We're also going to talk about suicide prevention and mental health. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Today, we're joined by Paul Mooney, veteran journalist who's reported on Burma, China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong since 1985. Katrina VandenHeuvel is editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. They're celebrating their 150th anniversary this year. Katrina will be in town on Tuesday. She'll be speaking on a panel about inequality at the Herbst Theater at 7 o'clock. Yesterday's guest, Robert Reich, will also be on that panel. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. I'm sure that a lot of you read The Nation magazine. If you have any questions for Katrina VandenHeuvel about The Nation and their investigations, about how they choose stories, what to focus on, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. And just overall, your thoughts on the state of investigative journalism. We were talking earlier also about just the number of outlets that are no longer overseas. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we have a question on Myanmar. Let's go to Alex in Oakland. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the show.
I think that's me. It's Alec. And it wasn't about Myanmar directly. It was about Katrina's comment about the United States exporting democracy. My comment is that the United States actually exports capitalism, and there's a vast difference between the two things, I think. And also, I was wondering why The Nation, I'm a subscriber, they're doing cruises when cruises are so destructive of the environment. Those are my comments.
So I agree with you that the United States, in exporting democracy, exports a certain form, which is heavily predicated on, as of now, a kind of speculative casino-style capitalism, which I'm sure Robert Reich spoke of on your program the other day. I'm no fan of this democracy promotion, which is not a new concept. It's been going on for decades and decades. It used to go on with coups. There is regime change, sort of a new name for that. That said, I think we're at an interesting moment in this country's history when you had, in the previous Democratic Party debate, a discussion about capitalism versus democratic socialism. I saw in a poll today that 56% of Democratic primary voters are very open, interested for socialism. So I think, again, I go back to my point that this is a moment where, you know, never say never. The politics of downsized, excluded alternatives is being upended. And the movements play a role in that, and the movements intersecting with the political process. On the cruise. So Ralph Nader's on the cruise this year, and when we go with Ralph Nader to various ports on the cruise, we meet with the countries and talk to them about how they benefit or how they can benefit more from the cruises coming into their ports. What kind of money do they get for investment in their country? The cruise is not fun. I hate to tell you that. I'm not a big cruiser, but it does allow us a certain revenue to invest in our journalism. What we have done more recently, which I'm proud of, is we've started trips to Cuba. If you're interested in those, please check out thenation.com. We run 4 trips a year now to Cuba and do it in alliance with movements and groups in Cuba to discuss culture, politics, journalism, climate, health. And check it out.
Katrina, so you take cruises every year. We've done shows on cruises, and I was always thinking that it'd be interesting if one of the speakers on your cruise actually wrote a story about the cruise and interviewed some of the workers, because, as you know, they're paid horrendous wages.
Absolutely. We have done coverage over the last, it's been almost more than 15 years. We have done coverage of the cruise industry. We have not specifically interviewed the workers, but that is a very good idea. We've done more focus on the environmental consequences of cruises and what can be done to mitigate those consequences. But the worker and interviewing workers is an interesting idea.
Yeah, if I were on one of your cruises, that's what I would do.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for calling in and emailing or calling. Sorry about that, Alec. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I know, Paul, just one more question on Myanmar. You're hoping to go back to the area to do some reporting.
Yes.
What are the stories that you want to write about this?
I'm very interested in Vietnam. Coverage of Vietnam's probably even less than Burma. There are fewer foreign correspondents in Vietnam right now. And considering the long history that we had with Vietnam, I just find it disappointing that we get so little news from that country. So I would like to kind of expand coverage of what's happening in Vietnam.
And right now you're waiting on your visa, but it's uncertain.
I haven't applied yet.
Okay.
But, you know, Vietnam has, like China, they strictly control the foreign media, and so I can't be positive that I'll be able to get a visa, but I'm going to try.
And so what happens behind the scenes? I mean, do they search for your articles and read about your perspectives and then decide, or?
Yeah, they do a background investigation. They ask you to supply articles. I think you know that I was rejected for a visa for China 2 years ago.
Right.
And I did an interview at the Chinese consulate in San Francisco, and they knew everything I'd done. They quoted to me from stories I'd written and things I'd even said. So, they look at your background, and are you going to be friendly to them or not?
And so are you going to reapply to go to China? Or do you think you'll ever be able to go back?
No, I think I believe I'm permanently blacklisted.
Permanently?
Yeah, normally it's 3 to 5 years when you're kicked out or refused a visa. When it happened to me, I was quite outspoken about the situation of the domestic and international media in China and the kind of the problems they face. I was quite outspoken about it. And so I think I may have, sealed my fate as far as going back to China.
And so we hope you get into Vietnam, and if you do, you have written for Reuters, Newsweek, the South China Morning Post, and Knight Ridder Financial News. Do you think that now that McClatchy is shutting down bureaus, it will rely on freelancers? I mean, what is it like for you to try to get your stories sold?
Yeah, it's become more and more difficult. People don't have budgets for international foreign reporting. And I rely a lot more now on internet-based news media. I found it increasingly difficult to get into newspapers and magazines in the U.S. because they just don't have the foreign budget anymore.
Katrina, what is it like at The Nation when you get pitched?
I will say that The Nation Institute, our sister organization, has an investigative fund which does support investigative journalism of different kinds. One thing we've done at The Nation is partnered with, for example, the Pulitzer Center, which specifically funds foreign investigative journalism, you know, outside this country. Going, and so it sends young journalists, all kinds of journalists, to parts around the globe. And I think those kinds of partnerships will become increasingly important. I'd say one other thing, which is that the profession of journalism is under assault, and I'm not talking in this country, though there is a sense sometimes of, you know, you got people lashing out at so-called, quote, liberal media, which is ridiculous when the real issues in my mind are the fight for internet democracy, fight against hyper-consolidation, fight for accountability, transparency, and not being stenographers to power. But if you look at Turkey today, the assault on journalism and on journalists as a profession is severe because of the attempts to control the flow of information and in the context of an increasingly repressive government. Again, I know Russia, what's happening there. The internet remains mostly free. It is not China. But there is a recentralization of state control, certainly television. On any given day in Moscow, there are more newspapers than there are in New York City, and they are quite free to criticize, though they too face financial pressures. But I'm involved, know a newspaper called Novaya Gazeta. One of their journalists, Anna Politkovskaya, was assassinated, gunned down 9 years ago for her investigative journalism. But the paper continues to expose corruption in the Kremlin, around the country. And there is also another press, which is more nationalist, which is also increasingly critical of the Kremlin for not being nationalist enough. So there, that goes on, and in the provinces as well. But it is very scary to witness the increasing violence against journalists around this world.
A few Russian journalists recently came to the UC Berkeley J School to talk about how difficult it is to do their work. In fact, I believe two of them left journalism altogether because they just continued to hit walls.
I have a very close friend who is with the Independent Journalists Union in Moscow. She's been organizing forums between Ukrainian Russian journalists, how to cover war conflict, how not to become weapons of war in the propaganda battles. There's no question it becomes increasingly difficult to be a journalist in Russia. But I, again, my concern with the one-sided narrative about Russia as a totalitarian society is it's journalistically lazy because there are many different forces in that society. And so much of what emerges from Russia is Putin, 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 as opposed to the fact that you have an ascendant Russian Orthodox Church, you have a Russian Tea Party, you have, you know, out in the provinces, you do have some small opposition parties. You do have a media that is facing both challenges but continues the print press in many places to continue to operate. You have a government which is accused of being Stalinist, yet a museum honoring the victims of the Gulag was just opened in Moscow 2 weeks ago, and there's a memorial finally being built after 50 years of calls to do so in honoring the memorial victims of Stalinism. And all I'm saying is it's a much more complex picture than you would get from what is a one-sided narrative in so much of our media.
Katrina VandenHeuvel is editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. They're celebrating their 150th anniversary this year. Katrina will be in San Francisco on Tuesday at an event about inequality. There's going to be a panel discussion at the Herbst Theater, 7 o'clock. We're also joined by Paul Mooney, a veteran freelance journalist who's reported on Burma, China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong since 1985. And now I would like to welcome Alexa O'Brien to the show. Alexa and her co-author, William Arkin, are national security consultants at Vice News, and they're out with a major investigative piece called The Most Militarized Universities in America. Hi, Alexa. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So you and William write that an information and intelligence shift has emerged in America's national security state over the last two decades, and that change has been reflected in the country's educational institutions as they have become increasingly tied to the military, intelligence, and law enforcement worlds. First off, what sparked this investigation?
Well, my co-author, William Arkin, obtained basically the educational and employment histories of over 90,000 members of the intelligence community that had top secret clearances. So that was the beginning of the investigation. The data set represented essentially 6% of the top super community. It is an enormous sample that offers great fidelity into the insight, that we glean about the makeup of the intelligence community. And then from there, what we did was we calculated, you know, how many people in the IC had degrees or certificates from, you know, each of the schools. And then we adjusted it using 51 additional other factors, which were based on an institution's affiliations with intelligence, homeland security, federal law enforcement, and the military. And it included everything from federal funding for research, as well as the school's academic, scientific, or security partnerships with the military, the IC, and law enforcement agencies.
You also found that more than 250 schools now offer certificates and degrees in homeland security, a relatively new discipline combining emergency management, physical security, and information security. How popular are these degrees?
They're very popular. In fact, when we look at the, you know, top academic concentrations, what we found is that the most common academic concentrations related to data, information systems, business management, systems engineering, and then criminal justice or criminology. And two growth areas were, as you pointed out, Homeland Security Studies, which is it's a questionable discipline with a questionable pedagogy because it was really established post 9/11 as a congressional mandate to increase expertise in this area to essentially populate the workforce needed for the newly established Department of Homeland Security. But another growth area that we've seen is law enforcement intelligence. So really, it gives you a sort of idea of what kinds of skills the intelligence community has, and it sort of breaks a lot of the sort of common myths that we have about the intelligence community. For example, fewer than 100 people out of this 90,000, the sample of more than 90,000 resumes, had graduate degrees in Middle Eastern studies. And less than 1% of them described themselves as Arabic linguists. So, you know, this whole notion post 9/11 that the intelligence community had a boots on the ground about faith and was going to focus on human intelligence, cultural and language expertise, we have proven to be absolutely erroneous.
Who is putting the curriculum together, say, for example, these degrees in Homeland Security?
Yeah, so the Center for Homeland Defense and Security University and Agency Partnership Initiative, which was essentially established through a congressional mandate after 9/11, devised this curriculum. And from that point forward, more and more schools adopted the curriculum. The curriculum is at, you know, given to these schools at no cost. And, you know, essentially, who designed it? That's a good question. it's not a new phenomenon. We saw this happen, you know, during the Cold War in anthropology and other social sciences where the intelligence community or the federal government has gone in to try to, you know, cultivate and build capacity and workforces that they need. So it's essentially a government-mandated pedagogy.
And Paul, do you see these kinds of relationships in China between universities and the Chinese military, for example? Or in other parts of the region where you've reported?
I'm really not familiar with that, but certainly in China there's very close ties between the government and the education system. All the universities are controlled by the party, and there are certain schools in China that train people who go into the intelligence community. So obviously there's a link there.
Does it get much reporting?
Of course
not.
No, not
at all.
No.
What about Russia, Katrina?
You know, but let me just bring it back to this country for a moment,
sure,
if I could, Rose, because I'm reminded, this report sounds extraordinary, but Bill Arkin, I want to say 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, did an extraordinary series with Dana Priest of the Washington Post showing the metastasizing, no longer just military-industrial, but military-industrial contractor post-9/11 state.
Right.
And I think you hear the consequences of that metastasizing state in this Vice report. And the militarization of society can happen, you know, in all kinds of countries in different ways. I think of what happens in our schools, the kind of military police pipeline in schools has militarized our education system to a certain extent. The fact that we put ourselves on a war footing after 9/11 instead of a vigilance footing, instead of intelligence, policing, but eternal, endless war, is I come back again to this constant which the nation has warned about, which is that endless war, perpetual war, is very toxic for democracy. So the valuable reporting and figures and statistics that are exposed in this series should make us think very hard about the balance between security and that contested term freedom in our country.
Well, and talking about war and peace, Alexa, you and William write, an overwhelming avalanche of intelligence information, a looming threat to cybersecurity, the echo chamber of Washington, the outsourcing of basic training to contractors. These are the realities of the national security state that are exerting a tremendous influence on higher education in America. As a result, what is too often being taught at these schools is not the art of war or peace, nor the capacity to understand the cost or benefits of either. Were you able to ask anyone about that? Alexa? Did we lose Alexa? Are you there?
Yeah, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Were you able, when you ended your piece by saying that what is often taught at these schools is not the art of war or peace, nor the capacity to understand the costs or benefits of either, were you able to ask anyone about that?
Absolutely. In fact, what we found was so interesting is we had reached out to academic administrators and other sources within these communities and also in the intelligence communities. And within academia, almost everybody asked us to stay off the record or didn't want to comment or didn't respond at all, which to us actually was very meaningful and significant, because what it said is that people were afraid to talk about this openly because in some ways, I mean, it could be for many reasons, but one of them is certainly that there is a symbiotic relationship and an incentivized relationship between these universities and the national security state, and that they're a major profit center for many of these schools.
And, you know, could I just say our longtime contributing editor, Gore Vidal, once said, "May the United States not become the United States of amnesia." The history that I hope the nation provides, but also what Alexa's describing, you know, is important to document today, but is not new. I mean, universities have played a central role in the national security state through time. I think of Vietnam. There were major protests on campuses against research institutes in universities playing a role, working with the Pentagon, working with the military. But to expose this is, again, at least to begin that process of accountability, which, Rose, I sometimes worry we're living in an era of the end of accountability, even while there is very good journalism going on. You've heard about much of it today. The funding of it, the business model of it,
right,
is imperiled. But there is very good journalism, and there are very important journalists here and globally.
We have time for one more caller. Let's hear from Irving in San Francisco. Hi, Irving.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I was in Burma in 1990 at a place in Manipur with the Federal University, and they had organized 35 ethnic groups to work together, and they set up a school that was amazing. I'm a high school teacher, and I wrote a book, It Couldn't Have Been the Pay, and this was one of the stories in my book. And one of the interesting things is that people who were very paramount in the organizing here with the Rohingya, the people who lived in, you know, who were being persecuted in Burma now. And they had a wonderful democratic setup, and the schools were run by the kids and the teachers, and it was a fantastic experience. It's a chapter in my book called Storytelling Along the Burma-Thai Border. And I just thought it would be real interesting, because there are a lot of Burmese people in the area here, and you could get some of them to talk about Burma and the way the way things are happening there now, and that problem with the Rohingya that somehow cropped up. Anyway,
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Irving. Yeah. Paul?
Yeah, actually, a lot of the Burmese people that are living here are, you know, portion of people that are refugees from the border areas and have suffered a lot. I think things have gotten worse in recent years with the Rohingya. In the last year or so, we've had record numbers of Rohingyas seeking to leave on the high seas, people being sold into slavery and dying, trying to escape.
Is there much reporting on the Rohingya?
Yeah, there's quite a bit. But the people that are there, we report on it quite a bit. We get criticized by the government for focusing too much on this issue.
And we have about 2 minutes left. What are you working on right now, Paul?
Right now I'm working on a story on how the Chinese government reaches into other countries to try to control or manipulate or intimidate Chinese citizens who are living abroad. You know, they'll threaten a journalist at Radio Free Asia by arresting the brother of the journalist, or they'll call in the parents. There's a Miss Canada who's Chinese, and they've called her, and she's been quite outspoken on human rights issues. They called her father in for tea, which kind of frightened him. Now she's not able to get a visa to go to Hainan Island in southern China for the Miss World pageant because they won't give her a visa. So these are the way that the Chinese government reaches into other countries and interferes with people's lives.
And what about you, Katrina? What are you working on right now?
I'm working on ensuring the nation live and thrive for another 150 years, and I'm working on a blog about what foreign policy, national security issues I hope will be raised in the debate, Democratic Party debate, tomorrow night.
Right. The next debate is tomorrow night.
That's right. So
yeah.
I'm hoping there's more attention, though. Obviously, there's always the link between what happens at home and in the world, but I'm hoping there will be at least maybe a question about, you know, what do we do with this nuclear arsenal? What do we do with the refugee crisis? What do we do, root out wasteful spending at the Pentagon? All sorts of different things like that.
And Alexa, just briefly, what are you working on?
Well, Bill and I are continuing to work on this as well as another project. But I just want to speak to something that Katrina said. There is no doubt that the relationship between the national security state and universities is a long one. But unlike the Vietnam era or the Cold War, the gloomy result is that the academy and by extension the philanthropic world has failed to establish a post 9/11 academic or scholars program to cultivate the next generation of experts who can offer a genuinely civilian counter narrative to the national security state.
That is Alexa O'Brien. She and her co-author Bill Arkin wrote The Most Militarized Universities in America for Vice. Paul Mooney is a veteran freelance journalist, and Katrina Vandenhoevel is editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. Thank you all for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the growing number of people facing astronomical rent increases and evictions in San Francisco and the Greater Bay Area. Between 2004 and 2014, San Francisco lost over 5,400 of its rent-controlled apartments. So how can Bay Area renters protect themselves in the most expensive housing market in the country? And what are cities doing to protect tenants' rights? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
Support for KALW comes from the 14th Annual Green Festival. Starting today, running through Sunday in a brand new location, the Cow Palace, here in San Francisco. For the first time ever, this historic venue will serve delicious vegan.